books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today let's look at some comics in audio. So from Daredevil Born Again to Thunderbirds to 2000 AD. It's all coming up in today's Read On, plus we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. Recently added to the RNIB library, along with many other Marvel comics, is
Daredevil Born Again by Chris Ryle, read by Seth Podowitz. The story begins not in Hell's Kitchen, Daredevil's New York hang, but rather in a dingy Mexican motel room, the unmaking of a hero, the laying bare of a masked adventurer's deepest secrets. That's where the revelation of Daredevil's closely guarded secret identity, that of blind lawyer Matt Murdock, starts him and his loved ones on a path more treacherous than any threat he has faced before. This is where Daredevil number 227, the first chapter in the seven-part saga that's come to be known as Born Again, begins.
Thanks to Bloomsbury, there are many of these books under the heading Marvel Age of Comics in the RNIB library. Each book takes you on a deep dive into the creators, characters, history, and cultural forces that shaped the Marvel Universe. Along with Daredevil Born Again is Doctor Strange, A Decade of Dark Magic, and The Mighty Avengers vs. the 1970s. To find these and many more, just search for Marvel in the RNIB library. And once again, many thanks to Bloomsbury for donating these books to RNIB. But why did I pick Daredevil Born Again as the clip to play? Well, season 2 of the Marvel series on Disney Plus starts very soon. And I spoke to the producers. Marvel's Daredevil is a TV series based on the comic of the same name, which follows Matt Murdock, a lawyer blinded as a child, who uses his heightened senses and elite fighting skills to combat crime in New York's Hell's Kitchen. By day, he defends the innocent, while by night, he operates as a masked vigilante to dismantle the criminal underworld, primarily targeting the powerful Wilson Fisk. It ran on Netflix from 2015 to 2018, and after a Daredevil cameo in the movie Spider-Man No Way Home, a new series called Daredevil Born Again premiered on Disney Plus in March 2025.
From black, a horizontal line appears in the center of the view, which widens and opens to reveal New York City at night. A searchlight sweeps over several buildings. Blurry circles of light superimpose the view, which pulls back and transitions into another location. The circles sharpen and give way to street lamps, shop lights, and car taillights near 10th Avenue and West 51st Street. Flashing red lights cast shadows on a wall, while elsewhere in the city, a cyclist rides down a street. A high view of two fire escapes tilts down and lands on a small sign hanging over a sidewalk. It reads, Nelson Murdock Page. Beneath it, Karen Page, Foggy Nelson, and Matt Murdock step out.
And now it's back for season 2. Mayor Wilson Fisk crushes New York City underfoot as he hunts down public enemy number one, the Hell's Kitchen vigilante known as Daredevil. But beneath the horned mask, Matt Murdock will try to fight back from the shadows to tear down the Kingpin's corrupt empire and redeem his home. Resist, rebel, rebuild. I talked to Daredevil Born Again showrunner and writer Dario Scardapane and executive producer with Marvel, Sana Amanat, and asked did they consult with any blind or partially sighted people or organisations.
In our first season, we had a writer who is visually impaired, and second season, yeah. And we've tried to stick with and stick by as accurate as you can be in this world, an accurate portrayal of the challenges of that community.
And he went through all of our other scripts as well, just gave us feedback as well.
And Sana, is accessibility, things like audio description, an important part of Daredevil Born Again?
Yeah, I mean, look, we are also very mindful of the fact that we want this to be as accessible as possible. So that absolutely is a part of our process. We also are thinking about, you know, this is a hyper version of his senses, but we are thinking about his senses and that experience and how it affects him and could potentially also overwhelm him, and how we integrate that into the storytelling of who this character ultimately is.
And Charlie even won an award from AFB for his portrayal of a blind person.
Oh, yeah. Yes, he is. He takes it. I will say, Charlie, he takes it very seriously. He has done a lot of research, a lot of training. He's the first one to tell us, like, if he did something wrong, you know, and very, very mindful of it, where his eyes are when he's performing, being mindful of the fact that he has to look a certain way, all of it. But then, of course, the trick of it is the fact that Matt Murdock, he might be blind,
but he can
but
see.
But he can see in a lot of ways.
That's the tricky
That's the
part
tricky
right
part.
There.
Yeah.
A logo, Marvel Television. In New York, Matt walks with Karen and Foggy.
A lot of time has passed. By the look of it, you've come up in the world.
I could say the same about you.
Fisk appears on screens in Times Square.
A mayor serves his city. I can see you're not entirely convinced.
Can you blame me?
Fisk brings his fist down.
I can't shake the feeling that you're gaming the system.
Why did you stop being a vigilante?
The line was crossed.
Daredevil's mask falls toward ambulances on a street below.
It's hard to come to terms with a violent nature.
A fight erupts in a subway station.
Hating the power it has over us.
Drops of blood land on a hardwood floor. Benjamin Poindexter wears an orange prison jumpsuit.
This city can't go unchecked.
Text appears. The devil's work is never done. At night, Matt strolls through a mob.
Sometimes, peace needs to be broken. And chaos must reign.
Frank Castle slams Matt against the locker.
Now, what can we expect in season two after, well, no spoilers, but Fisk's rise to power?
So the best way to put it is what you're seeing in season two is kind of the part two of season one, where in season one, Fisk has risen to power. We pick up in season two with the resistance to that power. And as Sun has said before, this is the fight. This is the fight for New York. This is the fight for Fisk to maintain power. And this is the fight for Daredevil and his resistance to topple that kingpin. So it's very large storytelling in season two. And we go on a... Once the villain has become the mayor of New York City, there's only kind of one place to go. And I think what happens at the end of this season is inevitable, tragic, and a little bit surprising.
Mm-hmm. There's a corrupt man in power. He's got a task force. Is it strange that there's an almost parallel mirror to actual headlines?
It's very strange considering that these were written 18 months ago, and that the task force was developed almost 10 years ago, if not more.
Yeah.
It's chilling when you write something kind of based on, you know, the rise of an autocrat tends to follow a similar playbook. The rise of a mayor like Fisk would follow a similar playbook, you know, establish a militia, establish a scapegoated community, go out and mess with that community to drum up support, use incredibly rich donors and shake them down. All of these elements of the story weren't drawn from the headlines. They were drawn from history. And then the headlines started reflecting the history. Now, what's the lesson to take away from that? I'm not one to teach any lessons, but we should learn from the past, or we are definitely doomed to repeat it, you know?
How excited were you to bring back to debut the Shadowlands suit on TV?
Oh, man.
So excited. I mean, it's the coolest one. And I think the interpretation of it is also really awesome. I mean, I think the fact that he spray painted it and the D is bleeding out from underneath, like it all like worked together. And it was a great combination of efforts between our biz dev departments, obviously the reference from the comics, Emily Gunshore and her costume department.
It was one of those times it all came together.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm very, very happy with how that came together and how it plays out throughout the season.
I love how Charlie just felt so cool in it. Like, yeah. He walked out, he looked awesome.
He's all
and
like,
he just like, I, he was like, had so much swagger. Just like, it's one of his favorite suits too. So it was great to see him come
the
alive.
First day we saw that, that was like, yeah. Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah.
Looks really cool.
Mind putting the hatchet down?
Frank swings the hatchet.
I was raised to believe in grace.
Matt knocks out a bank robber. A man puts on a white mask with black tiger stripes.
But I was also raised.
A door slides open for Matt, revealing a display of various Daredevil masks.
To believe in retribution.
Daredevil uses his club weapon like a whip. Flashes show more fights. A man breaks another man's arm. Matt screams. A title appears. Marvel Television, Daredevil, Born Again.
And just finally, how do you keep up with what else is going on in the MCU?
I don't. I mean, that's a bit, I'll be as honest as I can be. I can barely keep up with what's going on in this show. The thing that's great about working with Marvel is you have so many people who are so deeply involved. We have Drew Reiber, who's like the keeper of the flame.
Yeah.
So all of the scripts kind of go through a pipeline and let us know where we're at continuity-wise. Let us know what's going to happen. There are some secrets they tell me. There are some secrets they don't. I usually hear if the storyline is getting too close or too far away from the larger picture. But for most of it, I'm not as up to date as people inside the Marvel.
Yeah.
And you may be, you're privy to more secrets.
Yeah, I know more, but the secrets keep changing. So, you know what I mean? So we just constantly have to keep in touch and just make sure. But we have our own little playground here that we like to stick in because there's plenty of characters.
And they're kind of leaving us alone.
Yes, for the most part. For the most part.
Dario and Sana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Daredevil Born Again Season 1 is available on Disney Plus with audio description, and Season 2 is coming soon as well. And of course, thanks to Bloomsbury, Daredevil Born Again is available as an audiobook from RNIB Library, along with these two new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. Never Look Back by Susan Lewis was donated by HarperCollins.
I think, my love, that I might have come up with a way out of the unfortunate situation we're in. Rudy Kaplan had uttered the words softly, rhythmically, making them sound like part of a song. His wife, Romy Kaplan, looked up from the notebook she was writing in, and her heart skipped a beat as she watched him leave the piano. He'd spent the past half an hour there, playing some of the gently haunting tunes he'd composed in recent times. They were meant to soothe him, as her writings were meant to soothe her, and they did in their way, but the spectre of what was happening to them never truly went away, not even for a minute.
A dead husband, a missing wife, will they find her in time? Romy Kaplan has vanished from her home, or has she? When Romy begins posting on her social media accounts asking everyone to stop looking for her, the police are certain she's safe. But Romy's nearest and dearest are far from convinced. Her husband died in the bath under inconclusive circumstances 6 weeks ago, and Romy would never disappear without telling someone where she was going. As true crime podcast host Christy Ward picks up Romy's case, she has the whole world asking, where is Romy now?
As their eyes met, Romy's were already shining with hope and trust. She had so much faith in him that she sometimes feared it might be more of a burden to him than a blessing. He would insist, of course, that everything about her was a blessing, that the best thing he'd ever done in his life was marry her over 40 years ago. But she couldn't help fearing that the terrible events that had taken them over were weighing more heavily on him because of her. Casting a quick glance over her shoulder to where his eyes were now directed, she saw that he was staring at their portraits, hanging side by side over the dining table. In their elaborate gilt frames, They were too large for this tiny cottage. But there they were. And his, to her mind, was a true work of art. Whenever she assessed them as a pair, she felt that his had been created by a superior hand to the one that had created her own. But it hadn't. The same artist had done both, taking a lot of time to get to know them first, encouraging them to share stories of their lives together, their dreams for the future. In the end, the capturing of Rudy's charm and irony, the soulfulness in his deep brown eyes, the enlivening hints of him as a younger man, made Romy love the painting almost as much as its subject. Hers was different. Like her, and yet not, as though the artist hadn't quite seen her, or had maybe tried to turn her into someone else. The woman depicted certainly had Romy's naturally high cheekbones, full-lipped smile and silver blonde hair styled in a wispy sort of bob, but even Rudy, who professed to adore the painting, agreed that the playful light in her luminous violet eyes wasn't quite there. Nor was the infectious energy she exuded, or the natural vivacity that drew people to her. The crafted contours of her slender face made it appear more oval than heart-shaped, even a little harder than she was in reality.
Never Look Back by Susan Lewis is read by Kristen Atherton, Mark Meadows, Oliver Hembra, Lucy Price Lewis, and Catherine Walker Booth, and runs for 9 hours and 53 minutes.
The Winter Ball by Anton de Beck was given to us by Orion.
Maynard Charles, erstwhile director of the Buckingham Hotel, often wondered if life would have been easier if he had been able to remain in post, tending to the whims of that establishment's esteemed guests and wondering only about the quantities of foie gras in the hotel restaurant or the vintage of the cocktail lounge's finest champagne. Yet that was a lifetime ago. Tonight, he stood in the swirling snow of a Piccadilly back street, lighting up one of the White Owl cigars on which his constitution depended as he waited for his driver to appear. Behind him, the doors to the Deacon Club opened and closed, either admitting some shadowy figure into the warm interior or rejecting another into the bitter night. His face was set in a scowl beneath his black Homburg hat. His fingers fidgeted constantly, in time with his hammering heart.
1942, London. In the darkest times, hope lights the way. As the snow falls on Berkeley Square, the staff at the Buckingham Hotel are busy preparing for the arrival of American soldiers. King of the ballroom, Raymond de Guise, is rallying the performers for the forthcoming winter ball, with a familiar face returning to surprise the guests. As rumours circulate that the royal party will be in attendance on the night, tensions begin to rise on and off the dance floor, with shocking secrets are revealed. Raymond has always been a keeper of secrets, most especially his own. Unbeknownst to his friends and family, he's returned from the front line to the ballroom to feed information from high society to the British government. As the festive season approaches, he's given his most dangerous assignment yet, welcoming three American officials into his home with the knowledge that one is a traitor. As the Christmas baubles glitter, he must discover who has treachery in his heart before it's too late. Will Raymond be able to protect his home and his country? Or will this be the time he finally loses what he loves the most?
The car approached with scarcely a sound, gliding over the hard-packed snow. No headlights illuminated the blackout, so Maynard could not be certain the vehicle was for him. All the same, he hurried over, and in an act of faith, slipped directly into the back seat. Maynard was a middle-aged man of porcine proportions, but the driver was his exact opposite. Tall and angular, he had to hunch to keep inside the confines of the vehicle.
"I came as fast as I could, sir. The second I got the call, I..."
"Cartwright, I've no doubt about it. But drive, will you?" Mindful of the brutish tone of his voice, Maynard pitched forward and touched the man's shoulder. "This one sounds serious, old man. I'm grateful for your company." Travelling in the blackout was no easy feat, but Cartwright was used to it by now. No night was the same, of course, but the Luftwaffe's raids had grown fewer, and it had been many weeks since Maynard last heard the roar of the AKAK guns in the east. Unlike so many of his fellows at the office, Maynard was not driven by faith, but he found he was kneading his hands as if in prayer, and the dark mutterings he was making beneath his breath would have sounded to anyone else like a petition to God above. Sometimes in this line of work, you got a sense of foreboding that it was difficult to either acknowledge or ignore. Maynard Charles could not help feeling that something significant was coming tonight. It was the voice that had trembled down the telephone line only hours ago. The way the young man had whispered,
"I can't tell you. Not like this. Not on the line. Mr. Charles, I need to come in."
The Winter Ball by Anton Dubek is read by Thomas Judd and runs for 12 hours and 49 minutes. Next on Read On, and staying adjacent to the world of comics and fantasy, let's talk about narrator David Graham, who passed away aged 99 in September of 2024. I was lucky enough to speak to him at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. And although he's the voice of many a talking book, most listeners may be more familiar with him sounding like this.
"This is the stately home of Lady Penelope Creighton Ward. Parker speaking."
He's very well known for providing many voices for Gerry Anderson, including Parker and Brains in Thunderbirds, and was the co-inventor of the voice of the Daleks. And when he joined me in the Talking Book Studios, I asked him about his latest book.
It's called Lifting the Latch. It's a book narrated by a wonderful chap called Mont Abbott, who spent his whole life on the land in Oxfordshire, and he has total recall. It's about a dying world in a language that's dying out too. In fact, there's a glossary at the end of the book with words that you probably never have heard of. But an absolutely wonderful character. Sang in the church choir, a wonderful voice, never made much money, had two terrible accidents in his life which badly affected him, two tragedies, I would say, but indestructible. I admired him so much at the end of the book. He's a hero of mine now.
Now, it sounds like quite a challenging book to do.
It was a very challenging book because I had to work on the accent and the syntax. He had dictated the book to a lady who got it in all order, but he had wonderful memory, almost total recall. It wasn't an easy book to read, but it was well worth the effort that you just have to put into books. You prepare them. A lot of the work goes in preparation, it's not easy to read books, but it's very rewarding, I find.
How long have you been reading for RNIB now?
At least 25, maybe 30 years, I think. I started in the old studios in Great Portland Street when we recorded on tape, which was much, much more laborious than these days in state-of-the-art studios.
Are there any books in that 25 years that really stand out?
Well, I would say this one does for a start. Lifting the Latch. But I've read so many. There was a book on the history of the State of Israel by a famous English Jewish historian. They give me books which have Jewish references because I was born Jewish and, I know quite a lot about it. I enjoy reading them. But I must have read, getting on for hundreds, I don't know how many books I've read. It's difficult to recall particular ones. But I finished the Lifting the Latch, and I'm reading this book about, it's a children's book really, very funny and imaginative, about two young kids who come across a weird machine on their travels. So I've just started that as well. Which is, it's a doddle compared with the other book.
Now, some children will know your voice because you're Grandpa Pig in Peppa Pig.
Yes, that's right, and the wise old elf in Ben and Holly. And my voice career goes back a long way, starting with Gerry Anderson. And then I created the original Dalek voices, too, with an actor called Peter Hawkins many, many years ago, I think in 1962, Doctor Who. And I also appeared in two of the stories in Vision as an actor.
Yeah, because you go right back to the very beginning almost of Doctor Who. The episode Daleks was in 1963, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And then I did The Gunfighters, which I think was in black and white, with the first Doctor Who, where I played a cowardly barman, and it's become a very well-known one.
Mm.
And then I did another story with Tom Baker, which I played a Russian. It was City of Death, but it was a nice part. I had to age up, so from sort of middle age to old age, so they did a... They had to take me out and put me in front of a camera and then do a bit more so that it all came up in a flash, you see.
Yeah. Now, the voice of the Daleks is iconic. How did you actually come up with it?
Well, it was done in the old Lime Grove Studios in Shepherd's Bush. We just played around with it. I did it with a chap called Peter Hawkins, now sadly not alive anymore, an old friend of mine, and he was a marvellous voice man too. He did the Flowerpot Men and all sorts of stuff. We came at it from the approach that it needed to be stylized and menacing, and then they fed the voice through a synthesizer, so it made it even more menacing, and you know, so it went like something like that. That fouls, you know, that was that sort of stuttery thing.
And it seemed to
work because they've gone down in vocal history, haven't they?
Now, you're also very well known for playing both Brains Parker and Gordon Tracy in the Thunderbolts.
Yes.
How did that association with Gerry Anderson come about?
Well, that's a long time ago. It was in the 50s, if you can believe it. I was doing a television film down at Elstree, and in a pretty ropey script, and by one of those lovely accidents of fate, Gerry Anderson happened to be directing. And in between takes, I was playing some villain on the run. He mentioned that he was about to go into animation and puppet voices, cartoon voices. And I pricked up my ears at this. Well, I said, you know, I'm not bad at doing accents and voices, and if you do anything, I'd like to be considered. And about, I don't know, it was about 6 months later, he took my number and he phoned me, and then I ended up by doing five series for him, beginning with Four Feather Falls, then Supercar, Fireball XL5, Stingray, and the big one, Thunderbirds. So it had a big effect on my career. But of course, parallel to that, I was working in the theatre and in television, and then I was a member of Laurence Olivier's company at the National Theatre before the new building for 2 years, and that was a wonderful experience, and toured with them in Australia in The Front Page, and worked with Laurence Olivier in a play called Saturday, Sunday, Monday with Franco Zeffirelli, and I did other plays in the West End, Arturo Uy, which was a famous Brecht play, and then two plays with Leonard Rossiter, the great Leonard Rossiter, who played in Arturo Uy, and then in Make and Break, a Michael Frayn play. You know, so, you know, I've kept dotting about from radio to the theatre and television. You know, I've had my ups and downs, all actors do, but I've been lucky. You know, you've got to take your opportunities, and, you know, sometimes you meet the right people, and it has a terrific effect on your career.
You were Big Brother in the 1984 Apple advert. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was Ridley Scott. I mean, that came out of left field. I mean, I went to see him because I do voiceovers commercials, but I haven't done many visuals. And I went up, and he said he was casting Big Brother, and they picked me out to do it. And when I arrived at the studio, they gave me a page of script. Well, I said, why didn't you send it to me? I can't learn this. So they wrote it all up. And they dressed me in this sort of, they plastered my hair down, and I wore two pairs of glasses, and I ended up reading it off a crib, you know. You wouldn't notice it, but it became very famous. And they show it every year at the Super Bowl in America, which is a big American football game. And then I cop a few repeats over the years, which has been great. Good luck and cheerio.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Ah, the lovely David Graham. We'll have some more comics later on in today's Read On, but for now, let's return to RNIB Library.
SAS, the Great Train Raid, the most daring SAS mission of World War II, by Damien Lewis. It was given to us by Quercus.
The training camp was a desperately barren and inhospitable place at the best of times. But right now, in the dying days of the summer of 1943, it felt blisteringly hot and suffocatingly humid, as the fierce African sun beat down and the dust mingled with the clouds of whining mosquitoes. But that wasn't what most bothered the small body of elite warriors who had gathered to hear their mission orders. It was how the briefing had ended, and just what that might signify for their chances of survival. Captain Eric Bill Barkworth, the highly regarded intelligence officer of the Special Air Service, had laid out the specifics of the coming operation, at the end of which the red-haired lieutenant, Anthony Greville Bell, one of the few officers present, had pointed out the obvious. Barkworth had made no mention of how they were to get home again, once they'd parachuted deep behind enemy lines to cause untold havoc and mayhem.
"What about getting back?" Greville Bell asked pointedly.
To those gathered, it seemed an entirely reasonable question. While several of their previous missions had been nigh on suicidal, at least they'd had fast motor torpedo boats, MTBs, or stealthy submarines standing by, ready to pull them out of enemy territory and spirit them back to Allied lines. So what was the plan for the coming mission? What was the exit strategy? How were they supposed to make it home?
"That's up to you," Barkworth answered boldly.
Autumn 1943, the SAS hijack a train, raid deep into enemy territory and liberate a concentration camp. A mission so extraordinary, yet so secret, that barely any record exists. Via first-hand testimonies and long-hidden files, Damien Lewis has unearthed the incredible details, bringing to life an astonishing tale of bravery, daring, and determination, which showcases the SAS at their very finest.
On one level, the casual-seeming response didn't exactly surprise those present. In Lieutenant Colonel William Bill Sterling's 2 SAS, the 2nd Special Air Service Regiment, modelled upon the original SAS founded by his brother, David Sterling, nothing was viewed as being impossible. Nothing was deemed as being too much to ask of the men, nor beyond the boundaries of the human spirit or the capabilities of such finely honed and seasoned operators. That was especially so right then, for Bill Sterling's intention was to deploy scores of such raiding parties far behind the lines as Allied forces endeavoured to crowbar open fascist and Nazi Europe's fearsome defences. These 13 men were the forerunners, their mission to be proof of concept. If they could pull it off, Bill Sterling would have shown that his notion of mass, small-scale raids designed to paralyze the enemy's supply lines had real promise and might even turn the tide of the war. In short, this mission might earn Sterling the blessing to ensure that the SAS would be used as he intended, something that was far from being a given as the Allies prepared to make their first landings on European shores. Still, as one of those present would remark, regarding the lack of any getaway plan. In other words, after completing the mission, we would be on our own.
SAS, The Great Train Raid, by Damien Lewis, is read by Matt Bates and runs for 11 hours and 30 minutes.
Take Nothing for Granted, Tales from an Unexpected Life by Ross Kemp, was given to us by Seven Dials from the Hachette Group.
There's a very specific noise a bullet makes when it flies past your head. The whistling, swishing sound of air being displaced by a small piece of extremely hot metal travelling at twice the speed of sound. If you hear that noise, they're usually not missing by much. As we scrambled for cover, I found myself wondering, not for the first time over the years, if perhaps acting hadn't been so bad after all. Recently, I've gone back to acting, and I love it. My crew and I threw ourselves to the floor, sheltering behind whatever we could find on the exposed rooftop in Liari, a notorious region of Karachi. We were there to meet Uzair Baloch, one of the most wanted men in Pakistan, for a series of films we were making about parts of the world where extreme events were occurring. Baloch was either a freedom fighter or a murderer, depending on who you talked to. Earlier in the afternoon, we had spent time with him walking around Liari as he waved to the crowds who were calling out his name like he was a pop star. Then there were reports that the paramilitary force known as the Pakistan Rangers were moving in, and we went up to the roof to try and get a better view. And that's where I stood between Baloch and the cameraman when the shooting started.
Ross Kemp is famous for his portrayal of iconic hard man Grant Mitchell, and as the presenter of various documentaries exploring the most dangerous people and places on the planet. Here, for the first time ever, Ross shares tales from his remarkable life, from a childhood in Essex, most of which was spent in his mum's hairdressing salon, and pretending the fields and streams at the end of his garden were the Amazon rainforest, to finding himself travelling down the real thing 40 years later. Ross's life has taken many twists and turns. Through it all, there's been no plan, no roadmap, no strategy. Ross has gone from one wild adventure to the next, and never quite felt like he's fitted in anywhere. These are heartwarming and hilarious stories of the funny, scary, exciting and unbelievable things that have happened along the way. From renting a one-room flat that reeked of mould and damp at drama school, to his audition for EastEnders and filming shows in active war zones across the world, this is Ross Kemp, in his own words.
Sorry, Mum. I interviewed my mum on camera for a documentary a couple of years ago, and at one point I was trying to reassure her that what I was doing wouldn't be dangerous and not to worry. Her response was, "I've been worried about you since the day you were born." I've been shot at quite a lot over the years. When we were making films in Afghanistan, it was not uncommon to have five or six contacts with the enemy before 8 in the morning. You can get used to being shot at and it not feeling personal, but this felt very personal. We scrambled off the roof and into a safe room on the ground floor, where we watched as the news reported that Baloch had killed members of the British media and that government forces were preparing to move in and capture him. He tried to reassure us that he would never shoot us, which is one of those things that isn't actually that reassuring to hear someone say. There was a tense standoff as we made it clear we really needed to leave before the police raided, and our hosts tried to decide if it might be better to have us around if they did. Then the lights went out. What you're supposed to do when this happens is lie face down in the corner of the room so you're not hit by the explosion when the police blast their way in. What you're not supposed to do is pull out a cigarette lighter and do a piece to camera saying they've cut the power. I've never been good at following instructions. I was the same with toys on Christmas morning, and still am. Finally, after the sun had set and we'd paid our driver extra danger money, we were smuggled down a side road and made our way to the relative safety in the outskirts of Liari. The director caught my eye and said, "Leaving shot?" We were all still pretty shaken from our narrow escape, but we agreed we needed something to end the sequence. I set off down one end of the alley on my own, so I could come walking back and do my piece to camera. Then a tuk-tuk started coming slowly down the dark alleyway. I froze. This was at a time when everyone was on incredibly high alert for shootings and kidnappings, as they were happening so often. Then, at the end of the alley, It turned back around and pulled level with me as I was walking. Typical. We'd survived the roof only to be gunned down in the back alley. I held my breath as it drew level with me. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a shadowy arm raise and level something at my head. And as I turned, there was a sudden flash of light. I heard, in a loud and unmistakable Brummie accent, "Are you Grant Mitchell?" Then a giggle.
Take Nothing for Granted, Tales from an Unexpected Life, is written and read by Ross Kemp and runs for 8 hours and 7 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And finally, on today's comic-based read-on, let's turn to 2000 AD and the audio adaptations of such comics as Judge Dredd, America, and The Ballad of Halo Jones, which are more fully-fledged audio plays than regular audio books. Let's find out more. Written by some of the biggest names in comics. Available in audio now are the legendary 2000 AD comics Judge Dredd America, Judge Dredd the Pit, The Ballad of Halo Jones, Brink, and Slain the Horned God. Performed by a full ensemble cast and accompanied by an original score and immersive soundscapes, these are as close as someone with no sight can get to the classic graphic novels of 2000 AD. I'll talk to senior producer at Penguin Random House, Chris Thompson, in a moment about making such a visual medium available in audio, and about the surreal experience of sound designing a protest in Mega City 1 as the real-life Capitol building in Washington, D.C. was being stormed. But first, let's have a listen.
Dear Gort, when you read this, you'll know I'm dead. Sorry to break it so bluntly, but you know me. Subtle as a brick. I know you've always thought I take things too seriously. Relax, stop worrying, there's no point fighting. You can't beat Justice Department. That's your motto, isn't it, Gort?
Our next guest on The Breakfast Show is pop star, fit star, author, and general cool guy about town, Romeo Hepp. Romeo, how many women would you say you loved?
I'm Bishop Desmond Snodgrass, actually.
Well, I can't live like that anymore.
The studio has 2 security droids. Ready to take him?
Check.
Check. You okay, Hester?
A little nervous. I'll cope.
Right. Let's do it.
These are a series of 5 comics that have been turned into audiobooks. As part of a partnership between Penguin Random House and Rebellion.
Senior producer at Penguin Random House, Chris Thompson.
Essentially what we've done is we've taken the graphic novels, gone through them, pulled all the text out of them, and then treated them as drama scripts, gone in and sort of plotted the design of them, the sound design, recorded all of the actors, and we've then sort of gone in post to do all the mixing, all the music, all the effects, added all of that in. So essentially what we've tried to create is an audio representation or an audio interpretation, adaptation, whatever you want to call it, of these sort of well-loved comics that have been around for... Well, I mean, I don't know. I guess the ones that I worked on, the 3 that I worked on, were around late 70s, early 80s. So I worked specifically on Judge Dredd America, Judge Dredd The Pit, and I also worked on The Ballad of Halo Jones.
How hard is it, though, to get such a visual medium into audio?
The tricky brief that we had was that I want people who want to listen to them with the comic books alongside can do that, and they stand up to scrutiny because we've been ruthlessly faithful to the original scripts and to the content. There's barely anything that's changed at all, which has been a challenge. I think there's often a temptation in audio to sort of go, oh, well, we can just adapt that. But I think there's, you know, the number of occasions where we've had to do that, we could probably count on one hand. Alongside that, I also wanted people who hadn't had any contact with the graphic novels for the experience to work purely as a listener experience, which I suppose has always been my my interest anyway. And I'm by trade an audiobook producer. I must have produced something like over 300 books now. So my ear is always on how do we make this an experience that works entirely without the text. And so I guess that was the big challenge. You know, these books tend to be awash with detail that you miss on first reading inevitably, or that perhaps it's not so much that you miss it, but you just sense it. Your brain sort of registers it and then moves on because it's not front of the action. And I think certainly the biggest challenge for this was to not miss those details. I think I went into this thinking it would be quite a linear process of take the text out, plot the sound design, record the acting, execute the sound design, and that's it. But it just wasn't how it worked. In the end, I always had the comic alongside, because what I was finding when I was doing the sound design was I would get through a scene and do the design based on what I'd picked up visually. And then there'd be something that was off balance. There'd be something that's not quite working. And inevitably, this is what I mean, it's not linear. I would go back to the comic and find there'd be a little detail that perhaps my brain didn't register as important first time around. And as soon as that was put back in, everything felt back in harmony. And I think that's a testament to the effort that went into the writing and the illustrating of these books. And I guess that's the real challenge. It's sort of making sure that you're doing justice to the original work. The job was to render these visual worlds in audio. And so you're playing a lot with motion, you're playing a lot with proximity and distance, and it has to feel almost cinematic, but all you've got is your left ear and your right ear to play with. I think in the end, it ends up being an entirely an audio experience, but it really paints a picture.
Hey, what a doll, huh, Judge?
If she believes what she's saying, she's a fool. You believe it, you're a bigger fool.
Says you. Vanilla Batcave could tell me to think of rancid dog meat and I'd be happy to. You got such a down on her, why don't you arrest her? Boy, you'll soon find out what trouble is.
For me, that there was a moment that was completely surreal when me and Kate McDonald, who composed the music and did the production coordination of these books with me, really in the depths of the mix and of the design, around the time the Capitol was being stormed. Someone asked me the other day, you know, did you sort of take inspiration? Was it sort of, you know, were there any literal transpositions? I mean, I didn't take anything literal from what was happening, but there were moments, for example, in America where there's lots of crowd scenes, there are protests. And occasionally, if I felt like one of the scenes wasn't working, I actually went to those news clips and just tried to sort of soak in the soundscape, because there's something about a crowd scene that the way that it's experienced is you've got this sort of bigger picture background hubbub of thousands of people, but actually very rarely experience it from a height or from a distance. That not only made them feel incredibly relevant, but also was really useful in production. With America, as a result, I think we treated it a lot more like we're giving it a tug towards reality. And I think that worked in that sense. Joseph Fiennes as Dredd was a really, first of all, really controversial initially as a choice. But I was super excited when I heard that he was going to do it for us, because we wanted to do something slightly different. And I think particularly with Judge Dredd America, we wanted to anchor it in reality. The way Joseph plays Dredd is a lot less comic booky, if that's a term it now is, than you might expect. And I think what that does is pays tribute to his intelligence, which I think quite often is slightly overlooked in the depictions. He's just a brute. And actually, he's super smart. And particularly in America, he's playing politics. And there's something, I can't decide whether it's Machiavellian or pragmatic about the way he treats things. But the point is, there's a real streak of intelligence there, which I think we managed to really get across. The relevance of them, the pit, we treated it a little bit more otherworldly, but it's still dealing with police brutality and corruption. I read a lovely turn of phrase the other day. It's The Wire in a comic book world, which it sort of really works. I mean, as a massive fan of The Wire, it's funny. It had really occurred to me just because of how sprawling the plot is and how many characters and how complex it all seems, until you put everything in sequence and you realize what you're doing is painting this very detailed picture of corruption and police brutality within the force. There's no doubt they're absolutely relevant. I would also flag Halo Jones as flags feminist issues, you know, pretty much across the board. And it all does feel very relevant. I think that's the thing about all of these comics is that they're so heavy on satire, but somehow we don't seem to have moved quite enough, I would say, compared to when they were written. And so, therefore, the issues being discussed are still absolutely relevant.
Citizen Gort Hyman.
What do you want, Dredd?
A little cooperation. You see, Hyman, feelings are running pretty high out there. That speech you made didn't help matters. Unless we calm things down a little, a lot of people are going to get hurt. That's where you can help.
That's Joseph Fiennes as Judge Dredd. Now, how did you go about the casting?
The guy who did the casting was Duncan Honeyman and Kate McDonald, who I mentioned earlier. The way we approached it was we had a number of lead roles that we wanted to nail. Obviously, we were doing this across five dramas. For efficiency, what we did was we ended up having a chorus of about 20 actors who played multiple roles. And then on top of that, you've got the lead actors who did all the lead roles. Certainly a mammoth task in terms of getting that many actors together and making it all work. But I mean, the result speaks for itself. It does end up being a really sort of diverse listening experience as a result.
One thing we wouldn't get if we were reading the graphic novels is the music. How important is the music to these productions?
It was absolutely crucial. I was so pleasantly surprised. I remember early doors, I think when I was in the middle of putting the pit together, I remember saying to Kate, this is going to be more or less wall-to-wall music. And I didn't approach all of them in that way, but I think the pit, it was really useful to have that only because it's a sort of never-ending or seemingly never-ending sequence of scenes. You wouldn't necessarily know the link between each scene. And then once everything is put together, suddenly you realise that, you know, how clever the writing is, because every scene is advancing a particular element of the plot, and actually it does all fit together. The point is, to a listener, I wanted to make sure that the join between everything was very obvious, and that at no point where there was a link to be made, that it wasn't possible to make the link. And with America, it wasn't quite so necessary, but I mean, I had some absolute wow moments in terms of what Kate came up with. Very often what I would do is I would supply a scene with effects in, and I would just go through with time codes and say, okay, Kate, this is what I need here. This is what I want us to feel here. We need something to round this particular section off. You know, and I guess we'd discuss the aesthetic, broadly speaking, the way... the turn of phrase we came up with was it should be retro, but not dated. So in other words, it should be the sort of music that would have been composed at the time if they had the technology of nowadays, was the way the way we thought about it. And I think it sort of works. It's sort of quite heavily synthy. And then she also just had some absolute flashes of inspiration in terms of, I don't want to spoil the listener experience, but I think certainly the music in America is up there with my favourite ideas that she had. There was no steer from me to say, okay, this is the sort of tune I want. She just took it upon herself, had some absolute moments of genius, I think, in America. And then Halo Jones was another interesting one. I guess the hardest thing with Halo Jones is that there's a tone of bleakness throughout, and it's difficult to sort of sustain that. And obviously there are moments of you know, lightness here and there, but essentially the sort of recurring note of mine to Kate was, no, it's bleaker than that. Bleaker still, bleaker than that. And we sort of went back and forth like that. And once we found that tone, it sort of really worked, because I think it does need to have that sort of slightly dark, there's obviously lots of elements of humour, but a lot of it is dark humour. And I think what we ended up with was a really nice touch as well. And again, this is purely Kate's inspiration. It ends up sounding a bit like a space cowboy feel. It's almost a space Western feel to it, which I think, considering it's a bit of an odyssey, and it seemed to really work well with actually this fairly normal girl who ends up just being immensely cool by the end of the book.
Now, just finally, our backgrounds are sort of similar in that we're both being audiobook producers, although I remember the day when I was mastering to cassette. Listening to this, it used to be an actor in a studio. You'd record it, it was mastered, it was done, but the amount of production that's gone into these is kind of mind-blowing if you think back to the early days of recording. Do you think this is an exciting time for audio?
I could not think of a better time to be in audio. I mean, I started in audiobooks certainly 10 years ago. And I think, apart from anything else, in the last 3 years, I'm easily doing double the amount of books I used to do each year in terms of producing. Really, the first thing is that the technology is there, which means that if you want to build, you know, a complex soundscape, you name it, you know, there was a bit in Halo Jones where the note is sound waves can't escape this planet's gravity, and you've got to somehow create a space battle on this planet. You know, the technology is there. You can do that a lot easier because there's various sort of places you can find sounds and mix them together and sort of create these sort of new yet sci-fi sounding elements. So I think that's the first thing, is that it's a lot easier. The technology, apart from anything else, is it's easier to mix. Nowadays, you don't need, you know, a 24-track mixing desk to do that. But more than anything else, you know, there's also, on a consumer level, you don't need to carry 11 CDs around with you to listen to a long form product anymore, which means that the possibilities become a lot larger, essentially. And it almost, I have to say, listening to these and sort of having looked at the comics, it feels like now's the time for those books to be turned into audio, because now we can do it and we can really sort of throw everything in the kitchen sink at it. So, yeah, no, I mean, I cannot imagine being around at a better time for audio. I really feel like I've just been really lucky in terms of timings, basically. I was just at right place, right time.
From Penguin Random House and 2000 AD, Judge Dredd America, Judge Dredd the Pit, The Ballad of Halo Jones, Brink and Slain the Horned God are available now wherever you buy your audiobooks. And I'm happy to report that since that was recorded, all of those comic books have made their way into the RNIB Talking Books Library. That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.